Hello, you guys. This is Mickey Desai with The Thing About Cars. Around the table, we've got Becca.
Hello.
And Ben.
Hi.
And Don.
Present.
Excellent. Let's just jump right into it. Let's do. Let's start off the show with the moment of Grand Trivia Auto. This question I thought was pretty interesting. I had no idea that Chevrolet did this, but what model car did Chevrolet ship vertically during the 1970s? So apparently they actually shipped cars vertically during the 1970s. Was it the Chevrolet Vega? Was it a Chevette? The Malibu? Or the Chevy Citation? We'll come back to that at the end of the end of the episode. Why are you giggling, Becca?
It sounded like you almost said the Citation. and there was going to be a joke in with that.
Oh, sure, of course, yes.
And this meant shipping it from the manufacturer to the car dealer?
I don't know if it went straight to the dealer vertically, but it certainly went away from the manufacturer vertically.
I'm thinking it has to do with there was something left in the manufacturing process and it needed to ship that way for a reason.
Well, we'll come back to that answer at the end of the show. Let's get our normal agenda started here with something that's been on my mind. My Honda doesn't want to hold on to a charge, and I've actually replaced the battery in it. So I think it's one of two things. One, I know I've got an oil leak that's spraying oil all over the belt and all over the, you know, the passenger side of the engine, and it just looks like a mess in there. And I know the alternator is getting covered in oil, and I'm wondering if that has something to do with it. But I also have an aftermarket light, an LED light that I put up front, and the switch for it is always on, lit, right? The actual switch that says fog lights or whatever is on 24/7 with a tiny little LED blue light. And given that I'm not driving the car every day anymore, I think that's what's making the difference. I think it's just got a slow enough drain that over the course of a week, the charge just goes away.
But it's an LED light. I would think the draw would be so minimal.
You would think
So my convertible, I had a little bit of an older battery, and just the little clock in it drew down the battery enough to that it wouldn't start.
Wow. So I went to a socially distanced dinner two Sundays ago, and we all sat out in a parking lot, and I sat there with like a tailgate. So my trunk was open, and the little light, the little incandescent light in the trunk was on for, I don't know, it must have been 2 or 3 hours that we were there, and that was enough to kill the battery.
Well, that one should draw more. At least with the switch, you said it was aftermarket. If you were concerned about it, you could switch it from a hot all the time wire to just when the key is on. So that way it would only be illuminating while you were using the car as opposed to all the time.
Yeah, I have no idea what I'm looking at with this thing anymore. I need to get under the hood and take the switch out and start poking around. But that might be the way to go. Otherwise, my next experiment is to simply disconnect the lights in general and just see if that entire circuit is making the difference.
That's what I would do.
Well, yeah, that's what I was thinking, was you need to test the draw, and if it's easy enough to attach and reattach, if you installed it using a harness or something like that, and you could test the draw both with it connected and without it connected, that could give you an answer.
Right.
And so, yeah, I would say also, you know, take your voltmeter out to the car and do daily readings, you know, with and without it connected. You know, do a week with and a week without, and see, assuming you're not driving for a week, as you said a moment ago.
Right.
And during both of those weeks, your control week and your experiment week, check your daily voltage at the battery and see, you know, what difference you see.
That's not a bad idea. The other thing I was thinking I could do, which may be an overkill solution, was to put in a solar trickle charger on the dashboard. You know, get one of those 12-volt, 2-watt trickle chargers that plugs into your cigarette lighter, and just let that do its job for the time that I'm not actually driving the car. Since the car is no longer garaged, since I've moved, I don't have the ability to plug it in, right? I don't have the ability to plug in an actual AC to DC trickle charger.
Hmm. But, is that socket you'd be plugging it into hot all the time?
Oh, that is a good question.
Right, because if it's not, question. Then it's not going to help you.
Exactly. Well, what about a solar-powered one that connects to the battery?
Yeah, exactly. If I could do that, connect it to the battery or connect it to a hot circuit underneath the dashboard.
Because I don't like the idea of going through plugs anyways. Any trickle charger that I use attaches to the battery.
Yeah.
And while you're checking the battery voltage, at some point when it's low but still enough to start the car, try this. Connect your voltmeter, see what your voltage is, then start up and see how quickly it rises.
Right. Well, yeah, I was going to mention not just the voltage, but check your draw while you're at it as well.
So none of this should be caused by the oil leak that's over there saturating the belt and the alternator?
Well, no, it could be.
It could. Yeah. I mean, your alternator is meant to take some abuse because there's fluids, but, you know, anything. It could definitely be affecting it.
If the belt is slipping too much on the pulley, it might be turning enough that you're not getting the, you know, the red battery light in the dashboard, but may still not be turning enough to give you as much charge as would be ideal.
Right.
Right.
So what I need to do is wash off that part of the engine to see where the leak is actually coming from.
So,
and I'm always paranoid about washing the engine, especially since I'm now washing the alternator. That just doesn't seem to make much sense to me. But I guess that's just the way to go.
Yeah, just be careful. Don't hit it directly with a hose or anything like that. Right. You know, get as much of the oil up with rags or something before you start really washing as you can.
Yeah.
Well, water's only going to go so far as well. He needs a degreaser because it's oil.
Well, yeah, that's kind of a given. But there's a certain amount of, you know, moisture that these components are designed to withstand. You know, for instance, if you're ever, you know, driving in a really hard storm, it's going to get in there.
Of course. And I'll probably, you know, like you say, Ben, I'll blot it all up that I can, and I'll just hit the rest with either some sort of foaming engine cleaner or even simple green or something like that and just rinse it all off. But that has to happen. All right, so that more things on my to-do list.
And that might be a good segue into my other item.
Yeah, what's your other item?
Because I've mentioned a few times over the course of a few podcasts some issues with the Jeep. And I had known that there was an alternator issue. I could see the little quiet symptoms poking up, but when I started having problems with the oil pressure, or at least the code popping up that I was having problems with oil pressure, that became my priority, and I had been focused on that. But recently, my alternator decided to drop dead. So, or more or less, severely... not working well. I'm losing my words today. Anyways, through the course of that, I've discovered that my oil pressure sensor issue might actually be tied back to the alternator. It's a very interesting and aggravating thing that I have noticed, because everything that I've done to test my oil pressure, it keeps coming back. The oil pressure's okay. Why do I keep getting this code, this light, this... So I've now begun trying to change the alternator. And looking at it, should be a pretty straightforward repair. The alternator is right up on top and, you know, seems easy peasy, but it should have full, 15 millimeter bolts. They have 5/8 bolts on them.
Huh.
It's obviously already been replaced. It's not an OEM component. It's a known aftermarket company. I have hit these bolts with everything in my entire tool shed. I mean, I have tools that my mechanic friends have been jealous over. I have a ton of tools. I've hit it with everything. I cannot get these bolts loose to save my life. I've hit them with heat. I've hit it with, PB Blaster. I've tried the cheater bar, the breaker bar, the impact gun has some issues getting down in there, so then I'm forced to use the 90 degree joint, which, you know, doesn't help any. I've hit it with just about everything I can think of, and literally even the concussive shock, you know, the dead blow hammer and all that. I've tried everything. They won't budge. And I'm kind of left thinking, did they use Loctite on these bolts? Because I've seen it happen. I have run across.
Well, there's only one thing you can do, Becca.
Don't tell me sell the Jeep.
No, I was thinking call an exorcist.
Well, and to make matters worse, when they installed these bolts, I'm assuming they installed it using an impact gun because the corners are already rounded on the bolts.
How much heat have you subjected them to yet? I forget.
Well, I didn't measure temperature wise, and it was just a tiny little blowtorch. It's not like I got out a welder or something or other.
I was going to say, because that should have done it if it was Loctite.
It depends on which one. Remember on the Pontiac when I was trying to do the brake job, someone had to use red lock, thread lock on it instead of blue. I don't know. But so if anybody has any other ideas or possibly any listeners, ideas, what do you all do when you've got bolts that just won't come loose?
The idea that I've got is if you can get a rotary tool with a cutoff wheel close enough, just cut them off. Bolts are cheap.
I'm trying to even think if that's feasible.
Yeah, I said
tight areas. I'm just mentally going through what's right in front of me and if I could even that is so getting in there. And remember, this is the one that hauls around the kids.
You could also just blow it up.
Yeah.
Let's not.
Not that I should be speaking that out loud. That's off the record, by the way, for any police or insurance agencies that are listening.
No, no. I like my cars, even when they drive me absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
You know, I love my cars.
Yeah. Well, I hope you get it sorted, because that's annoying when people can't use the right bolt size and then it gets stuck. That's just annoying.
Well, I'm wondering if it's the people that installed it last or if it's the aftermarket alternator. Did it come with different bolts? Usually they don't come with bolts, but that's the little, little voice in the back of my head. It's maybe.
It's still the Loctite thing is like, who in their right mind is going to use Loctite on an alternator bolt?
I have seen people do weirder stuff. It's just that part of the problem of buying a used car is you never know who figured themselves to be a great shade tree mechanic and they went crazy with Loctite.
Right.
And I'm wondering, Becca, did you try to take this off before in a different weather outside?
Well, I only have the Georgia weather.
Like, it's interesting. Sometimes you try to move something and... Like, I've got this one lock that when it's in the wintertime, it's just sticks. And in the summertime, never have a problem with it.
Right. And that's the humidity and the heat and the cool. And yeah, and the throwing the heat at it, though, heating up the bolt should have helped there if that was going to be the case. Right. I actually turned a section of the bolt pretty white from applying heat to it, and there was still absolutely no change in it turning. So I don't think the little differences between AM and PM temperatures here right now is going to make a big difference.
So bizarre. Well,
anyway, another mystery.
Another mystery, yeah. Hopefully you can get it all sorted.
Well, what I need is then for somebody to maybe drop us a line and let me know if they have any ideas about getting this thing off.
Yeah. Yeah. And for the record, what's the year, make, and model on that thing?
It's a 2007 Jeep Liberty 4x4.
And what engine is in it?
3.7 liter.
3.7. Okay. All right. Cool. Thank you, Becca. Dawn, we had something on the agenda, speed limits.
Oh, yes. I it's interesting. Again, I'm going back to my 60s research of cars. Back in... I was reading this in 1965. We had the speed limit introduced, and it was 70s. That was the highway speed limit was in the 70s, and or 70, which I think was really fascinating. Just, you know, we were thinking that, and then a decade later in 75, we had it lowered to 55. And of course, all of this was around trying to save lives. I was doing some research and found, you know, in the 50s, we had James Dean die and probably some celebrities that pushed this issue a little farther. But yeah, I've been kind of thinking about that speed limit back then was in 70. And now we've got 75 around pretty good places now.
A few places. I don't think I've seen many of them in Georgia, though.
We mostly have 70 when you get further out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Ben, have you seen anything higher than 75 out there when your travels?
Not personally, but I'm aware that there are one or two places in the country that have 80, and I want to think there's one place in Texas that has 85.
Huh. I've heard Minnesota's kind of lax about some of their stuff like that.
Yeah, and then there's also, you know, very famous up in the Dakotas back in the 60s and early 70s, back before 55 came in, there were some places, you know, way, way out in the middle of nowhere, you know, up there in the Dakotas, where there actually was not a numerical limit posted. The sign said safe and prudent. Of course, that didn't last extremely long, and I'm sure there were a lot of, you know, legal battles over, you know, what is the definition of safe and prudent.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Depending on weather conditions and the kind of vehicle you're driving, and there's so many variables that could be plugged in there.
Cop pulls you over for going 150. You go into court and say, "Well, I thought it was safe and prudent."
Exactly.
Exactly.
So, which is kind of the way I've heard of one person getting out of a ticket that way. The cop walked up and said, "Hey, show me your pilot's license." And he did, so he got off.
Nice.
He was flying low, right?
He was flying low, exactly.
Yeah. But, so that was just an interesting thing. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say the speed limit in Atlanta is simply what speed the cars around you are going. It has nothing to do with what's on the sign.
So true. So true. And it's when my venturing in lately to Atlanta, I have so many people that have just been drag racing around us. It's really fascinating. You know, literally muscle cars just barreling down, zipping in and out. And I'm thinking, there's got to be a place for them to go. I mean, Road Atlanta or someplace in Red.
Not as much as there used to be, but there have been a lot of news stories. There were actual street races going on, and they were posting pictures and videos of the cars and whatever drivers they could get. They were looking for them. So there really was this stuff going on.
Well, the Saturday night or Sunday night races up and down the interstates have been going on for a long time, even before pandemic started. I would be, I'd be driving home, and you could count on it like a certain hour on a Sunday, you know, very late at night on a Sunday, you're guaranteed to be passed by a bajillion crotch rockets going 120 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. And that's just the way it's always been. The thing that you said a second ago, that there should be a place for people to go, I think that tracks have become sort of the playground of very wealthy people, and the common person doesn't have a place to go tool around with their cars anymore. Yeah. And maybe that's not a very fair statement for me to be saying, but that's what I'm going to say at the moment anyway. I think it would be cool to find that there's a facility where the average person can go and play.
Yeah, right. It would be, because I think of the 60s again, when you see all those movies, when they go out to the airport or Thunder Road and, you know, drive their cars and race against each other. And,
doing it in a legit and above board way is problematic for two reasons. One is cost, and second is, you know, legal issues.
And cost being related to an insurance as well, that no insurance entity in the world is going to
You don't the tell facility. Them you're driving out to that. Yeah.
No, I mean, if you own the facility, like if you and I were to go into business and build something called Thunder Road, where people can bring their cars and drive fast, the insurance policy that you and I would have to buy is also going to be prohibitively expensive.
Sure, well, and everything would be excluded out the wazoo, and everybody would have to sign a waiver at the front gate.
Right. No amount of waivers will get you past some problems, though.
That's right. Waivers tend not to hold up in court.
Yeah, but there used to be an eighth of a mile track out in Paulding County, and that one was kind of problematic for me anyways. When you have the more muscle cars that weigh too much, an eighth of a mile with very little stopping room is not a good place. But that was kind of, you know, our place to go, and now even that's gone.
Yep.
Well, and then we watched the Indy this past week, and one other topic that is so annoying to me is winning on a yellow flag.
Oh.
I hate that.
That doesn't seem right. Yeah.
It just seems like, I don't know, they should go ahead and do a red flag and then restart everybody and have them race to the finish. I mean, it's sad that we have these terrible accidents right before, you know, the last 10, 12, 15 laps. Mm-hmm. So we had a yellow flag winner again this year.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, boy. And I missed it. I didn't catch the race, so, yeah.
Well, they kept playing it over and over again, which was very interesting, because I caught the later I didn't catch it while it was live. I caught it when it was Memorex, and it was, I was not going to look at social media. I'm like, I'm going to watch the race pure, even though it's already been done. And then I was, oh, the accidents were incredible this year.
Oh goodness.
Yeah. Luckily nobody got hurt really bad as far as I could tell, and people walked away. Anyway, just thinking of all that speed limits and why we drive, and you know, some of us like to just go out for a Sunday drive, but some of us like to get the cars moving, and there's no place to really do that.
So I was looking at my notes, and we do have sort of a leftover listener question from the last time we did listener questions.
Okay.
And they're kind of related. One question from Nancy, one question from Alice, and they're both sort of somewhat related. Alice simply asks, how does one decide if a mechanic actually knows what he or she is talking about? And Nancy says, can we discuss tips for women so that they don't get taken advantage of, and they don't get taken for mindless empty shells at a repair shop? In other words, how can a woman walk in and make sure that she's not going to get taken advantage of, even if she's not an expert on cars?
Seth, I thought I had remembered answering something like that before.
We have come close to it. I haven't combined the two questions, but it's a thing we keep revisiting in, and Nancy in particular has also asked the same question a couple different ways, but I think it's worth covering again and again.
I actually, we did talk about, you know, having the person, if the part needs to be replaced, I want to see the part. It's my car. Kind of doing comparison shopping. But I will say, I think old fashioned wise, take a guy with you. And unfortunately, I've had this happen where my husband, I'll go, now we have a mechanic that knows me, knows that I know cars, and we come to them for things that we can't get done because we don't have the tools. But when I was looking for a new mechanic, I would walk in, see how they treated me, and then I would have Crisco. And like different car, one of our other cars, see how they treated him, and then decide if they were worth if they were really pulling one over.
Right.
Right.
It was almost like you have to be secret shopping and have a guy go in after you.
Yeah. Right. Well, and to Alice's question specifically, how does one decide if a mechanic actually knows what he or she is talking about? I think, you know, you try to do as much homework as you can on your car before you go in. And in my mind, I'm thinking that's YouTube videos.
Right. And it's hard to say, you know, here's what you can do without having any mechanical knowledge. It's difficult because that's it's the little mechanical details where they'll get you.
Right.
And I also think it depends on the year of the car. The newer the car, the more it's technical, electric, it's computers, it's coding, and do they have that knowledge? The older the car, the more grease monkey you need.
That one is actually a point that I had a check engine light come on one time, and I had taken it to a mechanic for the repairs. However, what they didn't know is I already knew what the code was. I knew what the code meant. I knew what needed to be done already. And they were not aware of that. So they, of course, tried to tell me it was something else, and it got ugly. So one piece of advice, if you have a check engine light, AutoZone will scan your computer for free and give you the code.
Yes.
They will tell you what it means, but you can also look up the code. You can look up the code specific to your vehicle, and it can give you an idea. That way, you know, you kind of have knowledge, but there are some mechanics that will tell you that code is something entirely different than what's actually showing up.
Plus, there are car forums that are not just car specific. I mean, there are generalized car forums, and then there are model and year model specific car forums that I think are worth trying to frequent. I don't think there's any harm in going online to say, hey, I'm a newbie. I'm not sure I know what I'm talking about. AutoZone says I'm throwing a P0050. What does this mean, and what do I have to do? And that's not a bad way to try to get help.
Right, but at bare minimum, if you've got a check engine light, make sure you know what the code is.
Right.
Because that's one way that people can take advantage of you.
Right. And isn't there some kind of little inexpensive one that you can plug in yourself and get some codes?
I have actually been testing one of those. I had so meant to do either a blog post or something on that. And it's been an interesting little device, and it's something that I could go into greater detail. There are interesting parts, but there are also drawbacks with it. The one I've been testing is called the Fixed. I'm trying to not go into too much detail, but it's like right now, it's showing me different codes than, say, my Actron is pulling.
And there's expensive ways to do it, and there's cheap ways to do it too.
So there's been some interesting differences, but it also has some benefits that have been interesting, or it's got some little things that are fun to play with.
Well, I have an Actron which desperately needs a firmware update, but then I also went out and got a couple of OBD2 fobs from eBay, and I think I spent maybe $10 or less on two different fobs each. And they talk to an app on my phone, and it gives me the same, or in some cases, more data than I get from my Actron. And and that's not a bad way to get, you know, at least OBD codes right from the palm of your own hand if you're willing to go that route.
Right.
But otherwise, like you said, simply driving to an auto parts store, I think all the major ones these days will read your codes for you for free. And if you're really feeling technical, get your own OBD reader. And if you're really, really feeling geeky, get the software for your computer. And do your own self-diagnosis with your PC at home.
That can be really fun. I used to have, back when I had Volkswagens, I had Mark IV GTI and a Mark IV Golf, and there was a guy in Pennsylvania who, one-man company, was making a kit like that. You know, you buy the cable, and then you'd buy a software download license, and it did everything. It did stuff that I never figured out. I could read codes, I could reset codes, I could watch the misfire count, and I saw a guy one time who was a more expert with this tool do some things on my car where, you know, he's sitting in the passenger seat with a laptop and I'm in the driver's seat and he's telling me to, you know, like say, press the clutch and brake at the same time and do other different control inputs because that would make things happen through the OBD in some of the deep areas that this program could get into. And just really amazing. And the hobbyist version was $250, which, you know, if you need a lot of resets, that pays for itself pretty quickly.
Well, $250 is pretty cheap considering some of the computer stuff out there.
Oh yeah.
Well, and
I had to do a reset every time I blew a coil, which was frequently.
So, and here's another question for people that are trying to, you know, be cost effective and make sure that the mechanics are not pulling one over on them. I wonder if you find out what's going on, you order the part, but you don't have the tools, you take it in and say, here's my part, this is what I need done.
Some places will do that. There are some places that are no longer allowing that, especially corporate chains, things like that. They're not allowing people to bring in parts anymore. Mm-hmm. It depends.
Yeah, it depends shop to shop. And there are some places that will still lend out or rent tools to you. So if you say, hey, I need to do this, you know, you leave them something and they'll loan you the wrench set to go get it taken care of. So would you guys believe that there's actually an attempt to make it illegal for people to work on their own cars by
shut up.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. I'm trying to find the exact reference here, but if in Massachusetts, there are ads being funded by the Alliance for Automotive Innovation, which includes members such as BMW Group, Bosch, FCA, PSA, Ferrari, Ford, GM, Honda, Hyundai, Kia, Isuzu, Jaguar, Land Rover, blah, blah, blah. And then what they're trying to say is that the owner doesn't have the right let me see if I can paraphrase this properly here. There are two votes. There's a thing that's coming up, and this was written back on Wednesday. So there's a vote that says a yes vote for this proposed legislation supports threat requiring manufacturers sell vehicles with telematics systems in Massachusetts to equip them with a standardized open data platform beginning with the model year 2022 that vehicle owners and independent repair facilities can basically get to. A no vote says that it opposes requiring vehicles be equipped with standard open data platforms, thereby maintaining vehicle owners and independent repair facilities may access mechanical and diagnostic data.
I think what they're saying is they are trying to keep the software on the computers proprietary.
Well, and,
which they have been, but
for a lesson on how badly this can go, just look at John Deere, right?
Oh yeah,
where people are trying to hack their own tractors just to be able to do their own work on a farm.
Right.
So yeah, that's the same thing that's happening here. And what's happening in Massachusetts is that they're running scare campaigns. The lobbying group, as it is saying to the citizenry in Massachusetts that allowing people to get access to this data can actually facilitate things like domestic violence, because now anybody with the right OBD reader can figure out through your GPS where you've been and where you're going to be and stuff like that.
It also kind of dovetails into the broader topic of what's known as right to repair legislation that is not industry specific,
right.
Which does not exist as yet or has not successfully been passed to my knowledge anywhere. But you have certain companies that do oppose it because they want to be the only source for repair. In fact, right now, this is one reason why even if I could afford one right now, I would not buy a Tesla, because yes, they do not support any repair outside of their own, you know, little controlled system.
Right. Gee, you hardly can get a charge outside a Tesla system.
Right.
Now, yeah, I that's a fascinating thing, because I think, gosh, it just limits so much of people's ability to really understand what their products are.
And what their products are, what they're paying for, exactly.
Yeah, and it also limits, you know, the individual's ability to do innovative things. Like, for instance, there are a lot of drivetrain components in Teslas that would be, you know, really cool to work with in experimental cars, you know, something you're building at home that might be kind of, you know, really thinking outside the envelope. Problem is, if something breaks and you call them looking for a part for it, they're going to want to know the VIN number of the vehicle it came from. And if it shows up as, you know, damaged or crashed or anything in their system, there's zero support for you.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. But I think there's a larger cultural issue at stake here. I mean, I remember hearing back in the 70s, when Coca-Cola originally went to India and said, hey, can we sell Coke in India? India said, yeah, sure, as long as you release the recipes to people so they can make their own Coke. Because India is very much a DIY place, or at least it was back in the day, where, you know, they wanted to give people who lived in rural India the ability to make their own beverages and make their own things and cook their own food. And Coke said, no way, we're not releasing the formula. So it took some years, decades, before India turned around and said, oh, you're right, we can still protect the formula for Coke and sell it in our country. So there, I think there's something similar at play, right? I mean, you know, the companies are now learning that they can make a ton more money by safeguarding the software and their systems and making sure that no one gets to work on their cars for repairs. And I think that's a terrible cultural thing to be doing to this country.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, Dawn is being very quiet.
It's awful. I'm my brain is just, that's just not the way this should go. I mean, we should all have the ability to tinker, full on. Not that I could replace the engine in my car. I don't have the equipment. I don't have the technical knowledge, but I should be able to say, okay, how bad is it? And what little pieces can I work on? And what do I need to not?
It just seems just patently un-American to tell me that I can't sit under, you know, the shade of a tree with me and my best friends working on my car with an alcoholic beverage of my choice in my hand.
Exactly.
You know, and just to be able to hobnob and do my thing to the thing that I bought, right? Never, you know, it's I spent how many thousands of dollars on it. I should be able to get in there and tear it apart and put it back together again.
Exactly. Well, and that's along the lines of what I was thinking. When you buy something, especially as expensive as a car, you should be buying with it the rights to every bit of it.
And that's, it gets into a whole, it opens up a huge can of worms of where does it stop? Can I not replace my windshield wipers? Can I not change out the radio?
Right.
I mean, those are cosmetic kind of things, but I think there's a real slippery slope, bad can of worms that gets opened with that.
Yep, exactly. So this fear-mongering tactic that these people are doing in Massachusetts, they're putting out an ad that's attempting to equate the ability of you or an independent mechanic you choose to read data from your car and then use that data to stalk or possibly sexually assault you. And
yeah, there are easier ways to do that sort of thing.
I was going to say.
Right. Yeah, it's called social media.
Right. Thank you. Exactly. If we're going to do that, let's take out Facebook. Let's take out, you know, LinkedIn for that matter.
Good Lord.
Right.
Yeah. So, but yeah, anyways, there's probably more to say about that, but I don't want to bog us down too hard. Ben, you put something on the agenda called cruise control weirdness.
Yeah. And I don't know how deep this topic's going to run, but this past week I was in a rental car that cruise control was a little weird. And of course, you know, I'm in all kinds of different cars week after week for my business travels. And I've noticed a lot of different interesting quirks with their cruise control systems. But this one was, it's one of these ones where anybody who's read our blog and seen my car reviews is familiar with the phrase, sometimes you get lucky, because you know, every now and then I score something really, really nice for a rental. This past week, I had a 3 Series BMW.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty nice. But the cruise control did something a little weird, and blame Germany a little bit for this, because one quirk with German cars is that their speedometers never read 100% accurately. They always read a little bit higher than actual speed, because there's a law in Germany that no speedometer can ever read less than your actual speed.
Oh.
And you know, even with you know tire wear and things like that taken into account, it must never read you know less than what you're actually going. It's one of those German safety you know things. Mm-hmm. So I'm in this BMW that has this cruise control, and it's not even their high end system. You know, they now have what both dynamic and active modes in their current cruise control. This was just basic; it had no distance sensing or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But what I did notice going through South Carolina, through Greenville, Spartanburg, and those places, was that it was reading, and I was going through Greenville and Spartanburg probably toward the later end of the evening commute time, that it was giving me about 4 miles per hour less actual than indicated by comparing with the nav app I was using in my phone. Mm-hmm. Whereas out in the middle of nowhere in flat country, the difference was much less. And of course, this through Greenville and Spartanburg, if any of you have ever driven the interstate through there, 85, it's got some hills and curves and things. Now, one thing that late model BMW cruise control does have is, I think this is the dynamic mode, where it'll use the car's brakes to shave off a little bit of speed going downhill and around curves, but none of this was happening. I didn't feel any braking forces, and the speed was still extremely consistent, so it wasn't like a system battling the topography. Is just this just even across the board difference from, you know, in a more urban area to a more rural area, even though it always said the same indicated number, the number I had selected, you know, at the time. I thought, well, huh, that is very weird. I know, you know, BMW does do some weird things sometimes with stuff like that, but it got me wondering about the broader subject of cruise control systems that do weird things. And you know, maybe some of y'all have some interesting experiences to relate.
You've got one data point on it, right? I wonder if it was simply that car, Ben. Like, if you got another BMW 3 Series, would it be the same?
Yeah, I don't know. But, you know, observing, and I wish I'd had it for a couple more days. It was the last day I had it that I noticed this. But, yeah, if I'd had it for longer after I'd noticed it, do a little more of different areas and, you know, compare those two numbers and see how much the difference varies.
Right. Yeah, my GL, for some reason, when I hardly ever use cruise control anymore, because for some reason it likes to speed up.
Oh.
It just, all of a sudden, I'll be driving and I'll all of a sudden it'll go start to go faster. And I'm like, whoa, it's supposed to be on cruise control. What the heck is happening? Mm-hmm. And you're right. Yeah. Like when you're in a terrain, sometimes you'll feel like if you're going up a hill, it's trying to work to keep that speed up, right, or it's braking to when you're going downhill, but this is like flat. And I'm like, wait, whoa, stop. And then I'll, you know, tap the brake and it'll go, oh, okay, I guess I can't do that. And then you have to reset it again. It's a very quirky cruise control in that GL.
Well, it could be worse, because the previous week I had a Dodge Challenger, which, you know, great car overall. We've got one here at home that we love. But it had a defect in its cruise control that I've seen some other Chrysler products manifest a few times, where everything will be fine for a while. Then you go and, you know, hit resume and the system just turns off. No matter how hard you try, now how many buttons you push, every time you try to use the cruise control, it just automatically shuts itself off. And the cure for it is to pull over, shut the car off, and restart.
My Chrysler Cirrus did that. Yes.
Yeah. You know, so, and that they made that one how long ago?
Oof, that car was a 99.
Right, and these are 2020 models of, you know, some Chrysler products that I've seen it on. So whatever the quirk is, they haven't gotten rid of it.
They haven't fixed it.
That's not good.
Crazy.
All right, yeah. So.
Well, as a side note, because I've actually heard this way too many times, so little asterisks over here. Don't use your cruise control when it's raining. Just an FYI to everybody out there.
That's right. Don't use the cruise control when it's raining.
Definitely. Use it when it's raining. I don't know why I've heard of that happening so much, but
I think it's probably some older advice. It's probably less relevant now with some of the integrated systems.
Possibly, but still. Yeah.
It would be very, very good advice if the only thing the system is reading is wheel speed. Mm-hmm. But modern systems are GPS enabled, so you know it may not be as relevant. And with modern traction control systems too.
Right. All right, so let's wrap up our episode for today with the answer to our grand trivia auto question. The question was, of course, what model car did Chevrolet ship vertically during the 1970s? We were finished with the cruise control discussion, right, Ben?
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, yeah.
Yeah. Right.
So what model car did Chevrolet ship vertically during the 1970s? Was it the Vega? Was it the Chevette? Was it the Malibu? Or was it the Citation? What do you guys think?
Well, I'm going to jump in here, Chris. If it's going to be on a flat, on a truck that has to go under a pass, it's got to be a small car. So I'm going with the Vega.
Mm-hmm. Becca, what do you think?
I don't know. I was leaning towards Vega or Citation. All right, we'll go with Vega.
Ben?
Well, let me preface it by saying that a great many cars leave the factory on trains, and there's a lot more vertical headroom to work with there. But that said, my gut says Chevette.
Ben is correct about the trains, first of all. But the answer is the VertiPack shipping system, designed specifically for the Chevrolet Vega, made it possible to ship 30 vehicles per rail car instead of just 15. All the cars were positioned nose down. And since they were shipped with all of their required fluids, certain aspects had to be specifically designed for this type of shipping, including an oil baffle in the engine, a special battery, and even a repositioned windshield washer reservoir. So, the Chevy Vega was the one that shipped vertically. And I don't, to the answer Don's original question, I don't know at what point it came off the train and went to a dealership. It had to at some point, but. But yeah, we're talking about rail car shippings, and so yes, it was a Chevy.
Yeah, so it had maybe higher passes, but still, that was my logic was.
Yeah.
It's got to get under stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Well, a rail car is a lot taller than any trailer out there. One of my fun stories from my brief little time with Uncle Sam was we had a tactical exercise out in California, and I was stationed in Georgia. And we had to train ship all our vehicles out there. And I was one of the people who got detailed to do some of the loading and unloading. And those double-decker car carrier railroad cars are a lot of fun. I drove several trucks on and off of those. And, it's something you just have to experience. It's hair-raising at first.
Maybe we should do a podcast called The Thing About Trains.
That'd be fun.
Trains are awesome.
They are.
All right, on that note, let's close the episode. Thank you, as always, to our friends for being a part of the Thing About Cars family. We appreciate your subscribing to the show and leaving us reviews wherever you can. We always look forward to your comments, questions. If you have a listener question that we can address on the show, please contact us through the website or on our Facebook page. And in the meantime, we hope you and yours are staying safe. We'll see you with another episode in about a week. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Later.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.